I don't know about you, but my brain is slowly exploding. That was some next generation thinking that I thought was extremely beneficial, because we had Tim taking us through the importance of being customer led as network and service providers. Alan with the features of that drive innovation, both open systems and open data and APIs and gadgets. Don with his extraordinarily large bandwidth requirements, and I'm still trying to figure out how you make some of those applications. We won't say that in mixed company. But I'm still trying to figure out how you're going to do some of those as mobile applications, unless you've got a really long fibre. And finally, the big piece about startups. But we've got 20 minutes for you to ask any of these extremely learned gentlemen any question that comes to your fancy. We've got one somewhere? I see a microphone walking. Does that mean there's a person at the other end of it waiting for a microphone? Yes.
This question is probably for Donald Clark.
Sorry, can we have name and affiliation?
Oh, sorry. Mark Barlow, tech strategist at Telecom.
Wow, that's a great job, Mark.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, actually.
I'll swap.
Is there any work being done around using quantum entanglement for future communication networks?
Only in so much as our community just allows that to happen, but that all happens over dark fibre and over just a few kilometres sort of links. So it's not a core feature what we focus on, which is data transit. Mm-hmm. And in New Zealand, to my knowledge, there's nobody that's working in quantum entanglement. I think a lot of that's Germany and the US. I guess, look, we're really excited. People, quantum computing and quantum entanglement in terms of cryptography would be fantastic operations. I think, though, I think they're going to happen over probably fiber, at least that's what they're trying. And I think there you won't even need a transmission layer. You'll just need basically an end-to-end dark fiber path. So in that case, all more grist to the mill for more dark fiber pairs.
Now I'm going to show my ignorance. One of you can tell me what quantum entanglement is.
It's just a way of using the indeterminability of quantum physics to encode information in such a way that you can't actually tap the information without distorting the information that was sent.
Right.
So it's allegedly sort of unbreakable crypto.
Okay, so it's about the cryptography, not the transmission. Okay, thank you. Over here.
My name is Naveen. I'm from Broadband Retail, Telecom, sorry. My question is really for Alan. We talk about open source and open data and sharing them on the web, but there's always the risk of this falling into the hands of bad people. Like, for example, there was this terrorist attack in India on the Taj Hotel, and there was in the news that the terrorists actually saw the Google Maps, and they found out the sensitive street information and the information where the cops was coming from, which roads they were coming from, things like that. So can you give me some information on that? Thank you.
Sure. I think it's important to realize that what's available in products like Google Maps or Google Earth, it's a reflection of, it's a reflection of information that's out there on the web. It's also information that's admittedly perhaps more readily available, but also available in other offline formats as well. So in the case of those terrorists from Pakistan, the street directories would have served the purpose. Perhaps by virtue of being able to go to maps, they didn't have to purchase the street directories, but the information was presumably available. I mean, I think the important point here is that this information is overwhelmingly, there are positive applications and benefits for this information. But as with any technology, yes, there can be nefarious uses, and I guess the classic trade-off between convenience and access and all the things that implies fostering innovation, and some potential negative implications. That's why, by the way, when we talk about opening up, say, public sector information, we realize there is some information that perhaps governments don't wish to open up, and rightfully so. There's information that perhaps does have national security implications that shouldn't be. But we would probably argue, you know, when in doubt, look to open up that information as much as possible.
Thank you. There's one over the back corner there.
Yes, David Butcher from Wellington, David Butcher and Associates. I understand that about 1830, when the British Parliament passed laws setting up the canal system, they wanted to encourage open access to the canals, so they put a prohibition on the canal owners providing barges and warehousing and other facilities. My question is to Tim, do you think that there's any chance that the regulation of telecoms might eventually catch up with this principle? Or alternatively, do you think the growth of next generation networks might actually make such forms of regulation unnecessary?
I'm actually going to demonstrate that I'm a complete nerd now. I think it was in about 1640 that the original legal jurisdiction for what later became known as must carry rules was developed. I wrote an article about this about 20 years ago, so it's sort of vaguely interesting because actually, if you look at it the other way around, I think what's happening is that people are going back, and whether it's canals, or the one that I like the most is the rules that related to draymen. For those people who don't know what a drayman is, this was a guy that had a wagon and a cart, and he'd go between villages in the 16th century England, and he had an obligation to carry anything. When he had space on the dray, he had an obligation to carry anything that people gave to him, and that became the basis for a public policy obligation to carry. It's also the basis for the public house, no longer the case in the UK, I have to say. You can be thrown out of a public house, but it used to be the case that you couldn't be thrown out because there was a public service obligation imposed on publicans to serve all of those people who came in desperate for alcohol. Now, I traced all of this back through the common law and wrote an article about it because it became the basis for the FCC's jurisdiction, and the FCC, when they were thinking about the 1934 Communications Act in the States, traced this piece of jurisprudence right the way back to the 16th century England, when they said that those things which are scarce but which have a public benefit should have this public policy objective of serving the public good imposed on them. So I think actually what you're talking about when you're looking at canals is another example of the same thinking. I think if you look forward, I wrote down three things which really trouble me about, you know, if I was sitting in the Commerce Commission or looking at fostering the development of a really exciting technological future for New Zealand. I think there are three things that need to change. The first one, which we know, which comes from partly that tradition, is how do you identify bottlenecks? I describe them as bottlenecks or pinch points. Essentially, economists would call them the creation of market power or dominance in a particular supply chain. How do you identify that when the speed of the development of the market is going so quickly and government intervention is normally a matter of great worry? Knowing where the problems arise almost will probably happen too late. So how does government actually monitor the economic bottlenecks is really, I think, one of the first questions that if I was looking at this, you'd really need to get to the bottom of. The second one is copyright. Kip Meek mentioned it very briefly this morning. But if you look at things like mashups and the things that people are actually developing, we look at the remix sort of thing, the way in which things are being combined and recombined, there's a huge amount of value there. But because copyright was originally developed over 100 years ago, and its application was for the printed media, its application in the technological space means that every time a piece of information goes through and is technically copied, you've got an infringement of copyright. So you've had a natural extension of copyright into much broader swathe of the economy, and I think that's a big question because it means that technically a lot of the things that are happening on the internet make criminals of our children, or at least a lot of the things that the children are doing that infringe copyright make themselves into criminals. And then finally, I think there's a big question about privacy. Where's this boundary, whether it's the question we just had or other questions, where's the boundary? You know, if somebody followed you around a bookstore looking at what you were happening to look at in the bookstore, you'd feel rather aggrieved, I'd have thought. But actually what happens over the internet is that the charting and mapping of your preferences, the things you're interested in, the places you go, the shops that you go in, happens almost automatically. And again, that sort of level of question about privacy, I don't think has been properly addressed, certainly not adequately in many places. There's three questions in there for other people. Do you think those are the right issues to be concerned about, or maybe there are others?
I think we'll come to that in a second. Does anyone else have any other questions or observations for those fine gentlemen? Is that Peter? Yeah. And there's one over to the left. Oh, you've got one there.
Peter Darling. A comment and a question, if I can. Actually, the thought of a network filled with bots worries me, because I know that at the moment, on many websites, it seems that the internet crawlers that Google and others have is actually the largest occupant. Likewise, the denial of service attacks and so on that define security. It seems to me that what you're doing is indicating some of the problems that we have at the moment with the network as a whole. And whilst certainly there is the privacy questions and so on that we just heard about, there's also the questions that perhaps we're going to need the different colours just to cover all the bots and things that are going to go. How are we going to take into account the fact that we actually want the network to do things we want rather than things we don't want?
I think there's a couple of people who'd have a go at that. But I was thinking first of Stefan.
It's absolutely, that's a key point, because you know, if you're looking at putting in all this infrastructure and the associated cost with it, you want it to you know, have some control over what it's used for in the end. And if you know 60-70% of the usage of that that infrastructure is beyond your control, because a couple of people a while ago set off these bots that are doing whatever they're doing and multiplying quickly and consuming all the available bandwidths, well, then that is a problem. I think one of the key problems about bots is actually once they're out there, how do you get them, how do you stop what they're doing? There's many examples of where bots are created and then the original developer leaves, dies, companies merge, whatever happens, but then there's actually not a lot of awareness that these bots are out there. And even getting to that point to know who's actually consuming that bandwidth is already this is a tricky bit. And anyone who owns a website, go back tonight and check your logs and see how many hits you get from crawlers and spiders and all that, and how that compares to actual users browsing your website.
I run a website and I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. You know, but I guess I'm not too worried about that, because I think there's a whole system, ecosystem of warfare that develops around this sort of stuff anyway, malicious usage, and has over the last 10, 20 years plus, and probably before that on different technologies that I'm not as familiar with. We have provisions in our contracts where if we notice our members doing something that's a bit silly, or one of their users is doing something that's sort of harming the rest of the network, we'll say, look, we think this is harming the rest of the network, could you stop it? And if they can't, we'll cut them off. And that gets harder when you have sort of DDoSes and all the rest of it. But, you know, to be honest, I guess history has shown that there's probably been lots of those technological scares with every new infrastructure and every new opportunity that's come in, and yet we're still here today. So I guess, you know, fundamentally, I don't necessarily have the answer, but I'm really not worried.
Okay, and down here was Scott.
Can I just one quick comment? I actually agree with what Donald just said. In fact, for every technology, there's a counter-technology. Every measure, there's a countermeasure. It may not be common knowledge, but a good part of Google's infrastructure is actually goes into identifying and defending against precisely these types of attacks, and that's actually a vital ingredient into what actually makes the cloud work.
Absolutely.
Without this technology, DOS type of defences, spam defences, the list goes on and on. We have a complete team called Common Abuse Tools, and it's a very, very long list of abuses which I won't share with you, but the point is that is part of the technology that makes cloud computing work, so it's par for the course, and companies that are embracing the cloud will invest in those countermeasures.
Sorry, Scott?
Oh, yes, Scott Marcus, Vic Consult Germany. This is a question mostly for Tim, and it links more really to the discussions from this morning about broadband. BT and Ofcom implemented a substantial functional separation, a really key example of that, and of course this is a relevant example for New Zealand, which also has a functional separation. Now, it seems to me there have been a lot of positive effects of the separation. You know, BT stock price generally has been up as a result, most people would say. From the regulatory and the public's perspective, there's been a huge take-up of unbundled local loop, which is certainly at least in part attributable to the separation. One important, at least a question, the deployment of fiber in the UK has been somewhat slower than in many European countries. At this point, I know you folks are looking to make some substantial fiber investments. But do you think the functional separation has any effect, negative, positive, up, down, on rate of fiber deployment, rate of next generation access deployment?
I don't have any sort of ready statistical basis for what I'm going to say, but just a thought is that one of the things that, you know, if you go back over the last 4 or 5 years, I remember arguing about local loop unbundling because we run networks across Europe and we've built out networks in strange and peculiar ways. It wasn't by design. So, for example, we built a network in the Netherlands with the Dutch railways. So if you go to the Netherlands, you'll find payphones on Dutch rail, British telecom payphones on Dutch railway stations. It's one of those peculiar things. Why did we do that? Well, because the Dutch railways wanted to do a deal with us where they have it's not really the footpaths, it's the railway system, and they could lay the fiber. We did the same sort of thing with an organization in Germany called the Bayernwerke, which is known as E.ON, which is a big energy company, and they had built out fiber, about 5,500 kilometers of fiber across Bavaria, not Germany, Bavaria. I guess the reason I was arguing against local loop unbundling at the time was that it was useless to us, because it was only the unbundling of the last link between the customer, and it was often not the business customer, it was the consumer and the exchange. And what we really needed was wholesale access. So, you know, why do that over there when actually what we want is here? That was the issue. Now, what happened in the UK was that because we've been arguing vociferously that that was the sort of thing that was needed, and so was cable and wireless, and so were all the other downstream operators, one of the first things they got was wholesale access. I can't prove it, but my guess would be that they got a pretty good interconnection arrangement such that actually if they wanted to go direct to a business customer that was going to pay for fiber because they wanted particularly to be there. Remember, the cable and wireless network is a figure eight fiber network anyway, so they were in most of the major conurbations. Going out to take advantage of the last mile wasn't really that necessary. It became much more, I think it's become much more valuable. Local loop unbundling has been combined with people like Carphone Warehouse that have used it as a combined underlying product for their offerings. So I think it's come into its own much more recently as a consumer-related thing. But the early business interconnection model enabled you to use the existing incumbents network at relatively good sort of prices in the UK. It's still a problem. We there's Ethernet access at wholesale level in the UK, and you can't get it in most other countries in Europe. So, you know, would you therefore drive demand for fiber? Possibly that's the case. I couldn't see the correlation. I can see the theory. There's no stats to back it up, I don't think. No.
Okay, now I'm going to have to call it an end to the questions there. So could I just ask you all to show your appreciation to our four panelists? Okay.
I have a four-year
break for afternoon tea, I have a task to give to you all. In the course of that presentation, in fact, Tim came up with a list of the three things that need to be done for an exciting future for broadband in New Zealand. I actually want to give you all that task. We didn't actually organise it in advance, it was just serendipitous. What I would like you to do is focus your minds on this question. If I can get up there. Which is, what needs to be different if New Zealand is to lead the world in NGN development? And I think you gave your three examples. What I wouldn't want you to do is not to do two things. I want you not to just think that yourself. I'd like you to discuss it with people around you, at your table, or over afternoon tea. But also, once you've got some agreement with somebody, so once you've got two people at least who agree, there's some little pieces of paper down behind that big chart at the back wall. I just want you to write on it what you one of those things, and there's some repositionable glue that you can stick on the back of that and just stick it on that piece of paper. And if when you get down there you find one that looks like the one you've just said, stick yours beside it. If you need to rearrange it all, rearrange it all. But I just want to give you all a chance to say, but as I said, I want it to be only once you've agreed with somebody, for you to get your input in to say what needs to be different in if New Zealand is to lead the world in NGN development. I can't force you to do it, it's an opportunity for you. That having been said, we look forward to seeing you back here at 3:30 this afternoon, in 30 minutes, for another session on services and applications, where we as an industry are going to try to be, as Tim Cohen encouraged us to be, customer-led. Thank you. Once again, can you thank the speakers?
I totally agree with your comments on copyright.